The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to What About Wealth?
Good morning. Good morning. It's Rick, great to be here.
this has been one of those weeks where I wish I were an attorney instead of a CPA, believe it or not.
Cranking out all those last-minute tax returns.
That's right. Yesterday was a filing deadline for all the business returns, and procrastination is the name of the game. And so yesterday was a big day. This whole week's been a bad week, but anyway, it's over, and now we just have October 15th to look forward to.
You know, that really shaped my career, my professional path, because early on I worked with a lawyer who was both a CPA and a lawyer, and I watched him do these big tax return crunches, and I just made a lifestyle choice that I'm never going to do a tax return. I'm not even going to do my own. I'm going to hire somebody else to do my own, and that's always been a good choice. And as a consequence of that, I've had a good relationship and worked well with lots of CPAs because I don't want to do what they do. I have no desire to do what they do. I need them on the team. I want their input and their participation in all the advice we give.
So what are we going to talk about today, Rick?
We are going to talk about an amazing topic, one of the oldest topics of all time, the deceitfulness of riches, which is a direct quote from Jesus. And we're going to talk about the effect of wealth on our family and our children. Is it a blessing or is it a curse? Does it help us or hurt us? Is leaving wealth to our children a good thing or a bad thing? And if we got as much wealth as we wanted, would we really be happy? What are the unintended consequences of wealth? And what things can we focus on to both personally and for our families to make perhaps the accumulation of wealth be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing? And look at the role that public service and our humanitarian issues and focusing on the needs of others has on our ability to accumulate wealth. And interestingly, wealth is an issue in the news. And I know you have some news stories, and so do I, but right now it's kind of front and center in the political debate. Do we want to have a political leader that acquired wealth through hard work and industry? Does that create desirable qualities of character, or does that make them distant and unable to relate to the common man? Or would we rather have someone who acquires wealth as a result of other people giving them money because they believe in the political positions that they espouse? Both presidential candidates, both the incumbent and the challenger, are actually very, very wealthy and have many, many millions of dollars, but they acquired it in completely different ways. So we get to ask the question, does the way in which we acquire wealth tell us something about a person's character, and do we care about that in the selection of our political leaders?
Well, some of us do.
And yeah.
So as far as other news things are concerned, we're gonna get back and focus on that. But just a couple of things that I thought would be important and interesting for our listeners is, and actually this sort of has political leanings as well. But Rick, if you had to guess, how much do you think other countries' currency manipulations cost the U.S. In our trading with them?
Oh, I have no idea, but I'm sure it's monstrous. I know that China props up its currency, and as has other trading partners in the past. I've never seen it quantified. I don't know what the number is.
Yeah, I hadn't either. That's why I was interested to read this, but there are people, the experts out there are saying that it's at least an eye-popping 2% of GDP.
Wow.
So, and that's huge. So, and for those.
Let me see if I understand this. They artificially strengthen their currency so they can buy more dollars, which means buy more stuff from us, or what does it
mean?
Yeah,
they artificially hold down the value of their national currencies, and just by doing that, they slice about $250 billion from U.S. economic growth in this year. And they worldwide government jigger currency values to the tune of nearly $1.5 trillion this year, and it's not just China. Apparently, China is big at this, but that only accounts for about one half of our losses. The other ones are big ones are Brazil, India, Thailand, Malaysia, Taiwan, Bolivia, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and even Denmark and Israel. And
wow.
So the question I have is, why do we put up with this? And because they do it to the EU, they do it to us. And apparently the damage would be even greater if we, if we started these trade wars and cracked down on these people. So anyway, it's just kind of something that we live with. But when our GDP is so anemic already, you really wonder if we couldn't do something better there. And maybe some guy in the White House with some business background might be able to figure that out.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I wonder.
It's
interesting to me, thinking historically about this, one of the reasons we abandoned the gold standard was that we were becoming an international debtor nation. Prior, when we had the gold standard, all of our borrowing, or the majority of our borrowing, was from our own citizens. We'd sell war bonds to our own people. But when we went away from that and started borrowing heavily from other nations, one of the challenges we had was they would come with these demand notes and say, yeah, as a matter of fact, we do want the gold. Give us the gold. You've got a gold standard. Your dollars are worth gold. We want the gold. And so there was an argument that other nations would come and plunder our gold reserves and would leave us bankrupt, which wouldn't happen if we didn't borrow money from them. But and so that's why we abandoned the gold reserve. But it sounds like they're doing it anyway. They're just figuring out more clever ways to make that happen.
Right. Last thing that that I thought might be interesting for some of our listeners is we've all noticed this, I think, but we have these huge leaps forward in automotive technology, and the interesting thing is that even though we've got these electronic sensors and onboard wireless communication, and people are saying, we've thought about this for years, but people are saying that cars that drive themselves really aren't at all far behind where we are now. And the interesting thing is that because of that, those leaps forward in technology, they expect there'll be fewer traffic jams, shorter travel times, so that should lead to increased productivity, as well as fuel efficiency, fewer crashes, less needs to expand roads, and plus a whole new area for in-car marketing. So You know, the
so you're not driving so that you can pay attention to the commercials. Is that what that
that's
means?
That's right. The car drives itself. You watch commercials. So anyway,
I don't know. The rugged individual. I want to get on my own horse, and I want to tell the horse where to go. I don't want the horse to be deciding my path here.
You just tell it, you know, before you go, just type it in. So anyway, apparently not as far in the future as we think. So anyway, just some, and then, you know, another political sort of thing is that the defense, you know how everybody's talking about, worried about all these defense cuts and everything that, that if we let the spending cut mandates go into effect, you know, 50% of that would happen in the defense area. But they're finding that the Pentagon is finding, and they're hiring actually more auditors right now, because they're finding that if they audit carefully the contracts that they have with people to build all this stuff for them, that they typically find at least 2% of the costs are improper. And so in their current backlog of contracts, that means they could save upwards of $12 billion just with that savings alone. And if they have, and if they have more auditors and people that are really focusing, they expect that it could be actually a lot bigger than that. So it could be, you know, $20-30 billion in savings just by looking carefully and doing what the rest of us do in business. Again, I ask, maybe it'd be good to have a guy with some business background in the White House. I still think that. So,
a guy that's had to be concerned about saving costs so that he can make a profit. That would be an interesting mindset for a political leader. That kind of be a novel approach. I think that career politicians that have never worked in or owned a business have a hard time understanding those issues.
Yeah, apparently we've had a few quotes from the current guy that make you think that, for sure.
I found a news thing here. A gentleman, a reclusive man in Nevada, passed away, and he was not found until a month after he'd been dead, at least a month. And the neighbors kind of finally called when his house started to smell bad. But he left only $200 in his bank account. But when officials came to clean out his house, they found gold bars and coins that have a value of at least $7 million. and he had no relatives, no known relatives, although they're looking for some. I'm sure there's plenty of volunteers coming forward. But gold coins from all over the place, a lot of them collector's items, and from all different countries. And he was kind of an anti-government conspiracy theory person whose house was found littered not only with gold but guns and the government's going to get you kind of books, which I was just thinking that maybe that would apply to a whole lot of my neighbors. Anybody who breaks into a house in my neighborhood is just flat crazy, because most of my neighbors would just as soon shoot an intruder as invite them to sit down for coffee. So
I'm sure your neighbors will appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, well, they would probably say, yeah, let them know. If they come in here, we'll use them for target practice. But just an interesting way to plan your estate. Stock up gold coins, leave them in shoe boxes in your closet, and when you're dead, somebody will find it.
How much of that do you think the government's going to take? That's what I was wondering.
You know, with no living relatives, all of it. And this is one of those things, if you don't have a plan for what's going to happen with your money, the government has a plan for you. They will happily come and collect that. And this includes even the contingencies of, well, what if I die and it's a plane crash, all my family members are dead with me, or nuclear holocaust, I have no living relatives whatsoever. Do you really want to let the government that you're so afraid of come and take all the money, or would you like to have that money go someplace where you get to choose? So it's just another reason to think about doing some planning.
Yeah, that is an interesting thought. These guys, a lot of these guys do that. They hoard stuff like this and don't plan because they're anti-government, and then who ends up with it?
It's the government. So. Yeah.
Anyway.
He didn't think through, well, what's going to happen with all this stuff when I'm dead? Who's going to come collect it? And there's nobody with the power and authority to do that outside the government. So it's going to be government officials that end up doing that.
Well, too bad. He probably thought he was going to live forever too. So,
yeah, he knew he was going to die someday, but not this day. But turns out he was wrong.
Right.
So today we have this kind of contemplative, reflective, maybe even a little spiritual dialogue about the effect of wealth upon us individually and our children. And I want to introduce this by telling a story I heard recently, and I've actually seen things similar to this with my own clients, but this one kind of struck home to me. An individual related to me that a man and his wife in their early 30s had been very successful in their business and were able to sell it, and net after taxes and the lawyers and all the costs, ended up with about $15 million and started living the dream. Bought their dream home, had their dream cars, took their dream vacations, had their little dream family, and raised their children who never wanted for anything and whose every whim was satisfied. And I should add, this was a spiritually well-grounded family. They didn't play with their toys on Sunday. They were very diligent in attending to their church and religious obligations. They served in their community, and they taught their children, or tried to teach their children good principles as they grew up. But as over time, as they've seen their children mature and go through the turmoil of teenage years and become young adults, they've had some very disturbing experiences. They've found that their children who have had all their needs met have absolutely no desire or incentive or willingness to work. They're not interested or concerned about education or getting grades. They don't care. None of them have gone to college. Most of them are either they got married because their girlfriend was pregnant, or they've just not bothered to get married, and they're in transient unmarried relationships that come and go. And the parents are now kind of distraught and looking at the effect of the wealth on their children, and have a sense that what seemed like just the most wonderful and perfect thing that could happen in their early 30s when they got this windfall of money fall on their lap. And it didn't really, because they built it. They earned it. They deserved it, I guess. But
well, I don't know. Maybe the government did it.
They didn't really do it. Somebody else gave that to them. But even having said that, sometimes how we manage those things have consequences. And I've been thinking about this for several days after I heard this account. And these are people that I know of, and I know the people around them. And it's made me meditate upon, gee, what the heck are we doing? We work our lives, and we struggle to accumulate wealth, and we struggle to not pay any more in taxes than we absolutely have to, and we plan our estates to avoid probate and avoid litigation, and yet if we do all these fancy footwork maneuvers to get more money and to leave more money to our families, if we leave that money and it turns our children into spoiled, rotten, good for nothing, lazy, unproductive, wasteful, self-indulgent brats, have we done anybody any favors? Those are the kind of people we hope they don't move in next door. We hope they don't date our daughters. On the other hand, we've all seen and experienced people that have, either by their own industry or even by inheritance, tremendous amounts of wealth. And they're powerful and productive and humble and highly effective leaders that bring value to the community and give tremendous amounts of service. And so I guess that just raises the question in our program, what about wealth? What about it? Is this, if we get it, can we manage to live with it and deal with it in a way that it doesn't just really mess up our children? Or is it just inevitable that having money is gonna screw up our kids no matter what we do?
Rick and I, we're gonna obviously continue to talk about that. Before we go to break here, I just wanted to let our listeners know that you actually have written an article which I've read several times called "Leave Your Estate to Your Children Without Ruining Them." And we're offering a free copy of that to anyone who contacts us, emails us, phones us. You can email us at info@whataboutwealth.com. You can call us at 480-324-8000. Be happy to get you a copy of that. So anyway, we'll continue with this discussion right after we get back from this break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're hearing more and more about the cloud and how we're using the cloud in our daily lives, whether we're aware of it or not. How can the cloud help your business? Join Bonnie D. Graham every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time for In the Cloud with Game Changers, presented by SAP on the Business Channel, and learn how to make your business soar to new heights.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. Very interesting topic we have going on here today. And Rick, as I mentioned before the break, has written about this and has lots of years, in fact, probably 30 years of experience dealing in these kind of family areas and planning and estate, all these things. So Rick, you're kind of the expert on the show today. So what do we do? What are the things that our listeners, our clients, what do we tell them to do to avoid these kind of things happening that you were describing in this, these people that had money early in their life?
Well, I want to answer that question by building on the title of our show, the Deceitfulness of Riches. That's actually a quote out of the New Testament from Jesus. Our listeners can find it in Matthew chapter 13, where he's giving the parable of the sower. And the sower sows the seeds, and the seeds fall on all these different kinds of grounds. And he specifically says for the seeds that fall in stony places, and this is for people who when they hear the word, they receive it with joy. But then after a while, when tribulation and persecution, when it gets tough, they're offended by the word. And it's also the one that they're scared away or kept away from enjoying the benefit of the word because and he uses two phrases, the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches that choke the word. And so I guess I want to encourage our listeners to think about this question. How is wealth deceptive? How does it cause us to not see things the way they really are? How does it blind us to the truth? And I think that ultimately, frankly, the answer to that question is not an economic one. It's not a social question. It's frankly a spiritual question. And so I think it's important for people to ask that on a spiritual level and explore it on a spiritual level. And there are a great deal of references in scriptural documents about wealth, the famous things like no man can serve two masters, and before you seek for riches, obtain the kingdom of heaven, and references to it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than to make it into heaven. And at the same time, there are other almost seemingly contradictory scriptural references that if you're righteous, you'll prosper in the land. And there's a beautiful verse in Deuteronomy chapter 8 that specifically says that it's the Lord our God that gives us power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant in us. So obtaining wealth can be an establishment of God's covenant, or it can be serving a master other than God. And I think that each of us have to answer that question personally and spiritually, and that's our own private quest. So I think the first thing I would tell anybody that's thinking about or concerned about this is to deliberately, on purpose, engage that spiritual dialogue. And then when we look at money, I just want to think through some things. When we have wealth, we tend to think that if I can fix the problem with my money, then it's a money problem. And it's not really a problem because I can make it go away. And on a practical level, okay, if I need a car and I have money, I can buy a car. If my car has a flat tire and I have money, well, I can just fix the tire. It's no big deal. And so we have these practical cares of the world kind of things that we treat that way. And then one of the overwhelming tendencies is to treat our own personal choices on a spiritual level in the same way and to treat our children in the same way. So if I have a problem, if I can use my money to make the problem go away, then it's not really a problem. So even on an emotional level or a psychological level, if I feel depressed, if I'm feeling a little blue, but I can go to the mall and I can buy stuff and that makes me feel better, well, then it's not really a problem. So we inoculate ourselves from the pains and traumas of life by using our money. And when this comes to children, it's almost catastrophic in its consequences. And I want to illustrate this with a simple story. If we have a child and we buy our little child, we get the little child an ice cream cone. So, you know, old enough that they can toddle, they can walk, old enough that they have some language skills so we can speak with them, old enough that they can ask, hey, can I have an ice cream? And we say, sure. So we're on a beautiful day, a beautiful afternoon in the park with our little child. And we get our little child an ice cream cone, and and they're toddling along with this, and we notice, hey, that's kind of precarious. They're not able to hold that ice cream cone. They're likely to drop it. So we say, hey, let's come. While you're eating your ice cream cone, let's sit down here. Let's sit down on this bench or on this curb or on this, find a place in the park where we can sit. Let's sit down here and while we're eating our ice cream cone, and we can get a walk around later. And the child, if they don't listen to us and get up and walk around anyway and hold the ice cream cone with one hand, what's going to happen? Plop. There it goes on the sidewalk. Now, what's the child going to do? Cry. Huh? I dropped my ice cream. It's smashed all over the sidewalk. I can't eat it anymore. And the child's very sad and very, very upset. And what's the parent think? I don't want my child to cry. I don't want my child to be upset. I don't want my child to suffer this pain. So I'm going to get him another ice cream cone. Doesn't cost us really anything. It's not going to impair our ability to make our house payments or to meet our financial obligations if we buy them another ice cream cone. It's not going to hurt us financially at all. It's no big deal. Money can fix this problem. So we, pop out another few coins out of our pocket and buy them another ice cream cone. But now, what have we taught them? We've taught them that, well, mommy and daddy can warn me about dangerous things, and I can ignore their advice. And if the bad thing happens that they warn me about, it's no big deal. They'll use their money to fix it. So I don't need to listen to mommy and daddy. Their warnings about dangerous things don't matter. And no matter what bad thing happens in my life, money can make it go away. So you take that now from a little toddler that's 3 or 4 or 5 years old, and you amplify that to a young teenager that's 16, that's driving the nice car that mommy and daddy bought them, that's out on a date with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, that's been told, hey, this activity's dangerous, the drugs are dangerous, the alcohol's dangerous, driving too fast is dangerous, making out in the back seat of your car is dangerous. There's all these dangerous things, but they think, well, it doesn't matter. Mommy, daddy told me that's dangerous, but I've ignored other warnings about danger, and it's had no consequences. They've used their money to bail me out. So now my girlfriend's pregnant, no big deal. Money can buy an abortion, no big deal. I wrapped my car around the tree, no big deal. Mommy and daddy will buy me a new one. I failed math in school, no big deal. I don't need to know math anyway. I can just use money to buy people who will do the math for me. So money tricks us into thinking that our problems are money problems, and they're not money problems. And in fact, when we use the money to fix those kind of problems, because it's not a money problem, the money actually makes it worse. It aggravates the problem. It teaches that child that they're not accountable for their choices. They're not accountable for what they do with their body or with their brain or with their friends. Money can bail it out. So money tricks us and deceives us into thinking that we can fix our problems with money when we can't. Money also tricks us into thinking that even as parents in our own lives, that our choices, that we're not necessarily accountable. And back to the story originally of the young family that in their early 30s suddenly, through their own hard work and industry, had this $15 million sale of a business. Those kids grew up, and this is what I'm hearing from relatives and family members. Those kids grew up watching daddy every day. He woke up when he was done sleeping. He'd stay up late at night and then wake up when he was done, and he'd get up and scratch and walk around the house and chase their mom a little bit and never really had to go to work and did whatever he wanted to do. And so the children's primary role models were people living a life of idleness and self-indulgence. And even though, mommy and daddy felt like, well, we earned this money. We're able to do this because we deserve it. Had not, I guess, thought through or didn't consider, maybe they still don't know, I don't know, what are the effects of my children seeing me live a life of idleness. So I don't know if that lays out the problem. Rich, have you seen situations like this where wealth has maybe not been such a good thing in a family?
Well, I think having done this as long as both of us have, we've definitely both seen that. There's, and I think it's just rampant, actually, of because it's, to me, it's kind of the old 80-20 rule, which I know is overused, but it seems like 80% of people that come into money and for whatever reason, like you say, inheritance or just because they built something and earned it, seem to have a real difficulty dealing with it in a positive way. And whether that's in the current generation or the next, it just does not seem to continue very long. And along the way, you see things, family members, children, strewn about in all sorts of difficult situations. So I remember a client that I worked for early on in my career, so this has been a long time, but this woman in this case had been left a business that had some, had patents on particular technology in a particular industry that that were enormously valuable. And even with that, it seemed not only was she able to run the business into the ground, but also all of her children along with it. And simply because it seemed that there were, from her parents who put this together, there just didn't seem to be any principles. There were no family values or principles or guidelines to go by that allowed this to continue. Those just had not been passed on, even though the parents had a great work ethic and a great public focus and what they wanted to do with their wealth. That just didn't seem to be passed on. And it, it just one of those situations where the company was run into the ground. It was sold for pennies on the dollar. The family ended up, all the kids in a big mess, and drugs, and all those kinds of things that you hope don't happen to people. So that's always been something that I've remembered, and I think about often as to, okay, how can we help our clients, or how can we help ourselves not end up in that situation? And I know that this article that you've written kind of goes through and enumerates some things that if applied, really help people with that. Because I'd rather turn out like, these wealthy families that I'm aware of. And, it's interesting that there are a few wealthy families that, gain a lot of public notoriety and stature, the DuPonts, the Kennedys, and, because they do things that are very public. But there are lots of other ones who do lots of really good things in the background, humanitarian things, and those families are continuing to generate good people and increasing wealth and increasing ability to touch important things around the world. And so I'd rather, obviously, would rather turn out that way than have our wealth squandered because of our children turning out in these difficult ways. So,
It's almost a proverb in America that one generation makes the wealth, the next generation enjoys the wealth, and the next generation loses the wealth. There's actually, in addition to a lot of scriptural references to this cycle, it has a variety of names. There's a book out there called The Fourth Turning that talks about the different attitudes of generations and how families and nations and societies and individuals go through these cycles. And And wealth is a significant element of the dynamic in that cycle. And the question is, are we doomed? Do we have to be? Are the generation that works their guts out to make and create wealth, and then who does good planning to leave it to future generations? Are they dooming the next generation? Okay, maybe their children aren't screwed up, but their grandchildren are going to be, and it's not going to be till their great grandchildren until it comes back around. And I don't want to leave our listeners in despair. When we come back from break, we're going to talk about some very specific things that we've observed that families that have a healthy relationship with wealth have done to minimize the risk and maximize the potential for the wealth being a blessing rather than a curse. And we can talk about that when we come back from break.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Take us on the go. It's even easier now. The Voice America Talk Radio Network has launched our mobile app for iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Visit the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market to download the app powered by Aircast. It's free and no registration is necessary. In minutes, you could be enjoying your favorite Voice America Talk Radio host, no matter where you are, in the car, out and about, while traveling, or anytime you can't be close to your computer. Catch up on the archives you've missed or discover new shows on the spot. Search Voice America at your favorite app store.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. Rick, it's been a good show. Now we're going to talk about some specific things because I think our listeners, probably everyone out there, has a story or stories in their family or other places that where they see these issues. So let's talk about specific things that are important to do in the family with your kids, so that if they when they end up with the wealth at some point, they won't. It won't ruin them, or it won't squander. They won't squander it away. What do you think? What are the most important things?
Okay, we're going to outline in the time we have remaining, if we can talk fast enough here, 10 very specific things for families to do, for parents to do as they deal with wealth in their family. And the number one is your children should see the money coming. They should know you have it. The idea that we can protect our children from the hazards of wealth by pretending to be broke is like thinking that we can protect our teenagers from the challenges of inappropriate sexual behavior by pretending that they were immaculately conceived. It's just not going to work. We do not protect our children from money by pretending that we don't have it. Now, that doesn't mean that they need to know the nitty-gritty details of our balance sheets and our financial statements, but they should know that we have something, even if it's modest. Even if, gee, Junior, I have $5,000 in the bank and you're going to get it someday when I'm dead, even if it's a very modest amount, they should know that something's going to come and that there's going to be an inheritance, because for whatever reason, this windfall psychology of money just dropping out of the sky from nowhere and I didn't know it was coming is really damaging to people. I think, among other things, if people can mentally play with the money before they get it, they can rule out some of the bad decisions they might make before the money's actually in their hands. So number one, they should see it coming. Number two, children from an early age should allow their children to participate in the management of assets. They should have things that they're responsible for. They should be able to make choices on what they do with their money, and they should be allowed to make mistakes. And this is simple things like basic accounting, how to balance a checkbook and how to pay your bills on time. But the other thing is making decisions about money. I know that we've helped our children earn money, and then when they have the money, they can make spending decisions. And it's interesting to be in a place with children and say, Daddy, look at this. This is really cool. Buy this for me. And hey, you know what? I don't want that. I'm not willing to use my money for that. But you have money. If you want that, you can buy that.
And they say, "Oh no, I don't think I want it."
Yeah, that's right. I don't want it that bad. But part of the reason they do that, they do say that, I would rather have my child at age 7 or at age 10 use their money to buy something really stupid and then regret it, than to prevent them from making it. So when my child says, hey, I'm going to use my money. In fact, I just had one of my young children spend a lot of money to buy a radio-controlled car and then promptly drive that car in the irrigation and ruin it. And it was their money. It was their choice to drive it in the irrigation. And it's very painful. And I want them to have that pain. I want them to understand that they looked at their bank account. They made the buying decision. They made the decision on how to use it. And I'm not bailing them out of that. So, which brings us to principle number three.
I was going to say, you just hit on the third principle, which is allowing natural consequences of their choices. And yeah, That's exactly the story you just told. So
it is. But and they need that. It's a mistake for parents to try and relieve their children of the pain of poor decisions by pulling out their checkbook. I remember in my youth, young man in my neighborhood who had very wealthy parents did a very bad thing that caused a lot of property damage, and there were threats that he was going to go to jail. And his daddy pulled out the checkbook and paid for all the damage, and the lesson Junior learned was, I can do anything I want, and even if it hurts people and destroys their property, my daddy can fix it with his checkbook. So that it really was very damaging to that young man, and I've watched him over his life. Now, he has, as an adult, I will say, learned some powerful lessons and actually turned into a pretty decent adult. But that was because daddy eventually figured out that using the checkbook to fix the problem didn't work. You gotta let them have the natural. Sorry, your ice cream cone fell on the ground. Isn't that sad that you didn't sit down like I told you to? Bummer. I'm not getting you another one. So,
Rick, the moving through these quickly, I know, is hard. But the next one is, no one should get something for nothing. And so, important thing is, free money is deadly money. And it's like you say, in one of your quotes, Gandhi's seven deadly sins is wealth without work is deadly, and money only has value when it's earned. So, and earning money requires work. So, that's something a lot of our clients worry about, I think, because when we have these estate planning laws, you know, where you have to make gifts and those kinds of things. It's important for us to build in things, and we can do that. And parents can build in things, statements of wishes, those kind of things that kind of put, they're not legal strings, but they're moral sort of strings on the money that says, look, you know, before you take this money, you know, I want you to do this and this and this. And those are things that parents can ask their children to do, and most children will follow those and turns them into good people, because then they're not getting something for nothing.
Yeah. When we do these estate planning moves with gifting and so forth, that can be done with proper planning, so it's not just handing the children a bunch of money. Number five is, I call this live the good life. Your children should see by the way you live that wealth is not about self-indulgence. They should see you giving service in your community. They should see you working. They should see you get up every day and have a reason to get up. They should see you engaged in a worthy cause. They should see you saving money and giving generously and using your wealth to do good. If your children, interestingly enough, they'll do with their money what they see you doing with yours. And this kind of brings us to our sixth principle, which is give. Families that have a healthy relationship with money consistently have a collaborative, shared participation in charitable activities, and they involve all their family members in giving to a church or to community projects, and they do it of their own free will, voluntarily. And I can tell you some wonderful stories about that. A brief one. I have participated in a family meeting with a conference where a 9-year-old girl had been told, okay, you have a charitable budget. Here's the number. And they gave her a dollar amount. And it was a pretty big dollar amount, a dollar amount that would buy a car, a nice car. And they said, here's your charitable budget. You've got to find a charity, research it, come back and make a proposal to the family council and convince us that we ought to allow you to give the money to that charity. And then after you do, well, which she did, she came and she gave a presentation. She had a presentation board. Here's my charity. Here's what they do. Here's how they're going to use the money that we give them. And then the family council reviewed that and said, okay, we approve this, but you have to now monitor that charity for this coming year and come back and report to us a year from now on what they did with the money that we gave them from our family foundation. That had a huge impact on that 9-year-old girl, who, by the way, now is in her late teens. She views wealth as a stewardship and a responsibility to bless those around her in a way that actually helps them. So giving generously and involving children in that process is important. Number seven is expect the best from your children. Our children will live up to the labels we put upon them. If we tell our children from a young age that they're stupid, that they're liars, that they're cheaters, that they're lazy, they will be all those things. If we tell them that they're hard workers, that they have the ability to do difficult things, and we expect it of them and we require it of them, they'll live up to that. So expect the best and treat them like they're going to succeed, and talk to them like they're going to succeed, and prepare them mentally to succeed, and they will. And then, of course, the flip side of that coin, principle number eight, is prepare for the worst. Regrettably, even in the most spiritually well-grounded, stable families where the parents are the most marvelous, wonderful people, children still get to make their own choices and can make bad choices. So you got to have a plan B. What are you going to do to hold them accountable if they're living in a way that's self-destructive, where adding wealth to their life would just be throwing gas on a fire that's already burning too hot? So be prepared to have incorporated into your legal planning, your estate planning, a plan B if they don't turn out the way you want. Principle number nine, and this is significant, is I call it teaching and applying true principles. We often get these rule-focused ideas that if people make do bad things, it's because we don't have the right rules. And if we just come up with the right rules, people won't do bad things. That's actually a silly notion, which is based upon the law of social contract and a common legal doctrine that's employed by courts and politicians today, but it just doesn't work. In fact, there's something called natural law, and these are laws that apply whether we know them or not, whether we believe them or not, they're true. So things like stealing is bad, killing people is bad, being rude, mean, and unkind to people is bad, being kind and generous is good. So these true principles lead us to freedom and power, and they're the root of all meaningful and lasting financial success. So figure out what those true principles are and teach them and apply them. And I've identified some of those in the article that I hope you call and ask for. And then the last principle number 10 is to demonstrate and live in a way that we are providing moral leadership for our families. Unfortunately, we live in a society where we're told that there's no such thing as right and wrong, where every choice is a good choice, just do whatever you want to. And that is a lie. That's another deceitfulness of wealth. Choices do matter. There is good and there is evil. And choosing good leads us to happy, blessed, productive, fruitful lives. And choosing bad leads us to miserable, pathetic, self-destructive lives that hurt a lot of other people. So understand that there's good and evil, and teach that and show it in the way you lead families. And hopefully that's going to help. I know we're running out of time here.
So, Rick, quickly here at the end, I know we probably are out of time, but let's just remind people, email us or call us, and we'll get you a copy of this article, which I think will be helpful to a lot of people. Review your estate plans. Make sure you write your own statements of wishes and express your values so that when you die, your children know what you want them to do. And make sure that you think about giving to charity now as an alternative to giving to your children, because in many cases, that will be a bigger blessing to them. So anyway, we will be back here again in a week on What About Wealth. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you then.
For listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.